Hello, ladies and gentlemen, listeners and viewers. This is Ron Stefanski with yet another episode of Disrupt Ed, the community that's growing among those who want to understand the ginormously disrupted world of learning and work. And so we tap out and look for those people, the cool and collected, the passionate and purpose-driven, the determined do-gooders out there, ordinary people who during the day are doing extraordinary things to advance the cause and to help all of us better understand these disrupted times. Today, I am joined by an international globetrotter, a former executive at Google, who is completely disrupting the world of sales marketing in businesses. And you're going to hear from William Gilchrist. Will, welcome to the show today. We're so happy to have you here.
Ron, super excited about this. Really, really cool stuff. And it's so great to kind of be dealing with the U.S., even though that's home. Very rarely do I get to kind of talk about what we do back home. So this is great.
I know. So I'm delighted that you are our first guest from across the shore. So you are in the Far East, centered yourself in Singapore. And I think for our listeners and viewers, there's something of a story here. So maybe that's where we're going to start to just cook this thing up, is to hear a little bit about what took an average guy from Chicago to all the way across the world, landing in Singapore, leaving a really, really great job at Google, and then going out there and creating an amazingly disruptive company, Consig. Tell us about your story there, Will.
Wow. Actually, the story to Singapore is actually a lifelong story, which is a bit odd, but I'll give you the abridged version, okay? And I always keep my age hidden internally, so I can't go on here and say how old I am because I try to like hide it. I'm a lot older than I seem, and I'm a lot younger than I should be. So it actually all started when I was 3 years old. So my parents, my dad, superintendent of schools for a district in Chicago. My mom's a children's book author, illustrator, and they both have a large appetite for international travel. And I think that my parents effectively raised me not to be super localized. Even though I had a very clearly American lifestyle growing up, every summer, every holiday, we were always traveling overseas. But it actually started when I was 3 years old because I was reading the World Book a lot. And I was...
It automatically paints you as a book nerd, which I love, by the way. And so...
Well, continue. There were three things that were super huge in my life. One, I had this globe where I could use a magnifying glass and look in and look at different countries and see the people from those countries. So that as a kid, that was a gift. So that was one thing. The second thing was the Encyclopedia Britannica, like the world book. And China was actually two books because it was the CH. So the CH dragged over into two books. So I would grab both CHs and I would read about China for some reason. I became super fascinated with China because it was so different than anything that I understood growing up in the south suburbs of Chicago. I'm from Olympia Fields, right? And it was so different for me that I started to obsessively as a child just look at the pictures first and then read, and I could memorize the China section of this world book, right? So then I started to ask my parents, I want to go on a trip to China. I want to go on a trip to China. So much so that even on my ninth birthday, I said, look, here are all the toys that I want for Christmas, or don't give me any toys, but just give me a trip to China. Like, you could choose the toys or a trip to China. And my parents picked the toys. So because I had this large desire to move to China, my parents started to take me overseas, but not to China. They took me into Europe quite often. And we were just going into Latin America, Europe, Canada. And we just kept doing that every year. So we'd go into France. I mean, I've been to 22 countries before the age of 13. Because my parents were just like, they weren't ready for Asia. They were just like, okay, we don't know much about Asia, but we'll take you everywhere else, right? And then I got my dream at 13 years old. I got to invited to the People to People Student Ambassador Program. And at 13 years old, I got to go alone to China, right? During to celebrate Hong Kong's return to Chinese rule, right? That might give away my age, but we're just going to move past that. But so I won't say what year that was, but it was a very long time ago and I was a kid. So at that point, I became obsessed because now I'd been in China as a kid alone. I had this lifelong dream, which wasn't many years at the time, but I had this lifelong dream of saying, okay, I need to go back there. And I started seeing Americans there, expats. I didn't know what an expat was. I didn't know at that young that you could be an American and live over there. And I saw this guy with this big mobile phone back in the day. And I was like, wow, he's got a mobile phone. And I remember being a boy in my student ambassador outfit. And I walked up to him and I said, it's amazing what you can say to a kid that will change their life, right? And I walked up to him and I said, wow, you're from America like me and you live here. Like, how do you do it? And the guy looked at me and he said, he didn't know me at all. He just said, look, it's really easy. You already did it. You got on the plane. Do it again. Do it again when you're my age and come back over. Just that easy. And at that point, it was just my mind was just boom. And then I was just obsessive. So all through high school, I was still traveling quite a bit and in Europe specifically. And then I went to college. I went to Bowdoin College in Maine and I majored in international relations and I minored in Chinese politics. And I was obsessively writing large thesis on, you know, hypothetical wars between US and China, but I never like lived there as an adult. So I was a huge poser. So once I graduated, I ended up, all my friends went to like Lehman Brothers and all these big banks and stuff like that. I said, no, I'm going to go move to China and teach public school. I was in the public school system in Shanghai teaching English. And that was my start to living in China as an adult. So while I was there, I ended up moving into a media relations role. So I ended up transferring from being in the public school system to a corporate job. But then I learned that I probably need to learn Chinese to be able to do this better. So after a year of that, I moved. I got into Cornell University, which is the Falcon program, which is a dual like diploma between Cornell and Beijing University. So I did Cornell for some time, graduated from that program. Then they moved me to Beijing University, Peking University. And then I got my final, you know, kind of diploma from there. So that was my grad studies. And right around that time is when the economy tanked. And boom, there was no one trying to hire anybody with an international relations undergrad and a Chinese grad degree. Right. This was not a. Wasn't the time for that, right? I wasn't an engineer. So I ended up going back to Chicago to be director of admissions of my old high school. And I did that for a year. And my dad was superintendent of schools. So I just got to mimic him. And I did really well. And then at that point, I said, but I don't really want to be in Chicago. That's not really what I've done, all this international experience. I've lived in China. Now I'm back home. It's kind of doing what I know. So I had never been to Singapore before. And there was an older alumni from Bowdoin College who was taking in interns. So I left my paying role in Chicago on a hope and a prayer with a suitcase and an understanding that I'd be working for no money. And I moved to Singapore to take an unpaid internship to do lead generation, which is outbound cold calls and, you know, for large tech firms. And, you know, he's still my mentor to this day. In fact, he's an advisor on my company now. Like, he's one of the closest people to me. I remember when I was coming here as an intern, he said, look, you have the skills. I'm just going to polish you. You need to know what sales is, and taught me sales, like literally. He wrote a book, actually in the book where I'm kind of in the book. And, you know, he was like, look, you need to learn the sales stuff because you will always be able to exist anywhere in the world, any culture. Sales is the one skill that you'll always be able to use. And that was kind of the start of my journey in Singapore. So long answer, but my route to Singapore started when I was 3 years old. So there was a lot going
on. I think it's interesting because having been a foreign exchange student and spending a year abroad in Austria, I learned a lot about, you know, you talked about localization. And I think it's important for our listeners and viewers to recognize that getting to another country and living there, not as a tourist, but as a citizen or as a community member or community visitor, you know, allows you to experience a different culture, not simply view it from a distance as a tourist in a bus. And I think that's what commands the most riveting aspect of foreign travel and travel abroad, is it changes the lens upon which you view the world, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that traveling expands your mind. Nothing's worse than you know, having an opinion about the world when you actually haven't been to the places that you have opinions on, right? And I think that that oftentimes has been a lot of the challenges there. I mean, I've become far more open to concepts as a result of my travels, far more clear about kind of what I believe in, even or even my own identity, from seeing other identities exist. And yeah, I think that living and localizing yourself in a region that's not your home region is probably the most priceless thing you can do in your lifetime.
Well, and in this disrupted world, we're talking about disruption on a massive scale. So we're talking about disruption driven by technology. We're talking about disruption driven by globalization. And now here we have someone who's participating in the center of the storm. So, Will, as you started looking, and I think it's also important to say, you know, in a profession selling that was completely disrupted by the third force that we experience in this disrupted world, which was a worldwide pandemic. So now you have this interesting lens upon which to reframe some part of the business world. So tell us a little bit. So you center yourself in Singapore in the world of sales now. You're working for big tech, and suddenly you come upon this vision, this light bulb moment where you decide, you know what? This needs to be totally different. Talk to us about that, because I think that's a very fascinating part of your story.
Absolutely. And I got to be careful because I hope I'm not bashing my former company. And I'm definitely not, as a disclaimer, because this is more of a macro issue than an issue with specific companies. But when I was working for TSL Marketing, actually before as the intern, and then I became a full-time employee there, and I was learning sales, learning outbound calling, learning pitching and things like that. When I ended up going to corporate, in particular, Google, what I found was that the kind of street knowledge that I was learning in terms of how to sell, it was effective when I was actually selling. However, it was not effective in terms of how I was communicating what needed to happen in terms of a corporate structure, because people were operating on a very archaic template. Templates that actually weren't very effective. They were just things that would get you through meetings or things that would get you promoted. Or as long as you said these particular phrases and organized the slide deck in a certain way, you would get promoted. Or as long as you were able to tote certain narratives, even though they were not necessarily practical or closing the deal, that was usually supported a lot more than the person that was actively going out there, like doing cold, hard sales, getting those hard rejections, or really kind of connecting. So I started to see that gap. And then I had a lot of friends from other companies as well that were experiencing the same thing. And they also went through the same kind of system that I did under TSL Marketing. So once I started to see that, I was in a bubble where I thought I was kind of the crazy one. Even though I was closing business and generating revenue and all that stuff, I just noticed that the progression opportunities were not really there, right? It was really, I think real sales or real cold sales was not that respected. It was more, how do you navigate the company, or how do you navigate your manager, or how do you play a certain role that they've defined as a salesperson versus actually being one? And that in itself brought me to a really strange place when I was in corporate, because I felt, well, who's actually doing this stuff? Instead of navigating a chart sheet to be able to make sure that you're hitting your numbers based on how the CRM is structured, or based on the rules of when you talk to this person or whatever, like who actually sold it, right? Once I started to see that happening, that for me made me think like, you know, where are the real salespeople out here? Where are the people that sit there? It's a safe place. There's no politics, no bureaucracy. Let's just go try to close deals. Let's be good salespeople. Let's sell good products for good reasons. Let's not convince anybody or lie, right? That's kind of what led me to leave the corporate space and actually go into the startup space, not even to start my own business. I had the idea, sort of, but I never had any kind of courage or bravery to actually do it. I was actually forced into that. Now I can go into that later, but going to the startup space, I noticed that the startups had the same problems that corporate did, which is that no one has the sales thing really figured out. And everyone's just navigating narratives versus actually being hardcore salespeople.
You know, it's really fascinating. You shared this outside of the episode when we were talking. And the fact is, when you were working for Google and you were selling, one of the things I found fascinating is the difficulty of selling Google. I think of Google as a premier brand out there and one that commands a lot of attention, a lot of respect, obviously. But it's not nearly that easy to sell something like that. And so you're really putting a student lens and an international lens on the transaction or on the relationship building that leads to meaningful, mutually beneficial relationships that consummate in business and sales. So I'm interested in that because you obviously learned something there that triggered a switch and prompted you to think about, wow, a lot of people are doing this wrong. When you find that a lot of people are doing something that's not working, but it's veiled as success, that's the opening curtain for disruption, right? Because now you can do something totally different. No one's even considering that it's going to work. And yet it works on a massive scale, as you've proven out in your own company. So talk to me about that, when you started seeing that piece of it.
So it's interesting, right? Because as I was noticing those different gaps, one thing that I found in one of the quotes that I absolutely find hilarious, I don't know if I hate it or if I find it super humorous, I'm not quite sure yet, I'm still working on it, is when people say, wow, you know what, Google must be really easy to sell. And it's not, because everybody wants a t-shirt and a lunch. They'll show up to the meeting because they want the t-shirt and maybe a lunch and maybe go have a tour of the office. But when it comes down to actually opening up your wallet, well, then I'll get back to you, right? It's actually very difficult to sell because you have to navigate the fact that everybody wants to have a meeting. Everybody will want to have a meeting, but then
you... So you're almost clogging up your pipeline with people who are, you know, pseudo prospects, right? People who appear to be interested, but are never going to do business with you.
That was more often than not. In fact, that was one of the harder sales roles because of that. Everyone was interested. And this is back, I mean, back, I don't know what it's like there now. I mean, I left in 2015, but back in the day, it was just that. It was just people very starstruck and very interested in the idea that, or wanted to tell people they were talking to Google or wanted to take a selfie at the front desk with the logo behind, right? Everybody wanted that. But, you know, when it came down to an invoice, absolutely not. Right. So I didn't. And that was a cultural shift, because when I went to the startup space, I didn't have that behind me. So the meetings were not as plentiful. However, some of the challenges were the same in terms of how even startups viewed sales, right? Unrealistic expectations and kind of podcast narratives and blog narratives and, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk narratives. You know, all those things sound very interesting until you've actually done the work on the ground for a while. And then from there, you're like, wait a second, this sounds good, but you have to find your own way.
So you're helping to distinguish our podcast from a poser podcast to one that we're actually talking about the fact that sales is an intricate profession. And I've always viewed it that way. And I think that's what you're intrinsically saying, is that to be really good in the world of sales, you really have to be self-aware. You have to be a lifelong learner. You have to look at it the way other professionals look at their profession, the law or medicine, for example, single contributors that are learning their entire life and going to school their entire life and improving upon their technique and improving upon their craft. And sometimes that gets lost in the sales world, because we get a lot of people in it who simply are posing and are saying things like, you know, I don't want to go through that training because I've been through it already. And yet we've seen the world of business and how the world conducts business through a sales transaction markedly disrupted by globalization, the pandemic, and the advance of technology. So talk to me about the technology aspect of it, because it seems to me that technology has an opportunity to advance our understanding of how to be effective in the world of sales and marketing, but it's also doing a terrible disservice. And what I mean by a terrible disservice is it's convincing a lot of young people coming into the profession to say, oh, it's a numbers game. So I'm going to send out a lot of connection requests, and then I'm going to auto respond once they click that connect button, and I'm going to pitch them my wares. And that's literally setting us back in my mind, because it's defining sales as something of a trick. You know, I'm going to send enough of these out. Do you want to buy this? Do you want to buy this? And it's not even the basic act of qualifying a prospect. So talk to me about that piece of it, because you've spent a lot of time as you are moving from startup mode into your own company to really dissecting what it means to be effective in the craft of selling.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look, I always use this analogy, right? Where being a salesperson is like being an athlete in a professional sports team. You have seasons, you have quarters, you have a team, you have a coach, and you have stats. And I'm actually currently writing a book, and that kind of goes into it a little bit. But the reality is, you know, everybody really thinks that they can do sales. Not everybody thinks that they're a plumber, though. It's interesting. A plumber is a respected skill set that people admit. Right. Okay, I can probably fix a sink. Right. I can fix a sink, but I'm not a plumber. But when it comes to sales, everybody thinks it's just walking around sipping coffee, being funny and charismatic, and trying to bring people through. When it comes to technology and this gamifying stuff and sending out large automated emails, and if you send out this much, then this is what's going to happen guaranteed, I equate it to this specific example. Anybody can, and I'm from Chicago, so I'm going to use an American sport, or really a Canadian sport, sorry, Canadians, but we kind of took it, but basketball. Anybody can take a basketball, sit in front of a basketball hoop and shoot the ball, and it'll hit the hoop and you'll score, right? Anybody can do that. You can probably do that 1,000 times a night for practice, and the ball could go in every single time. Great. We all know that that could happen. Try that in a 40,000 person stadium cheering. You have a jersey on and you have Shaquille O'Neal on the other side sweating, just dying to block the shot. Try to hit that exact same shot. That's what makes you a professional. Now, most people look at, well, look, I'm out here and I shoot this shot and it goes in every time. Okay, great. That means I should then since I can do it, you're saying you're a professional. Go out into the stadium and shoot that same shot. I've done it, but you've done it over here. You haven't done it in the heat, in the realities. It doesn't matter how many ChatGPTs you use, or how many automated messages that you use, and how many numerical. Once you get to the meat of the skill set, what do you have? And it's not just reading off a bunch of slides and talking about value. Nobody cares about your product. It's about an actual skill to be able to morph it to something that is relevant to someone else. And that's what makes a professional salesperson different from somebody who's just selling. Are you a salesperson? Or are you just selling?
I think that's a really important distinction. It's also a really great point for us to take a break. I want to continue this conversation. I want our listeners and viewers to recognize this is another disrupted episode talking about the amazingly disrupted world of sales and marketing within companies in this ginormously disrupted 5G wire technology, interconnected, globally interdependent workforce-enabled world of work. And we're talking to a very exciting international interloper, Will Gilchrist, who's talking about the very nature of sales. So if you're listening to this episode and enjoying it, come back to us in a minute with episode 2. If you're really enjoying it, think about that salesperson in your life that would really benefit from a dose of reality and a real interesting perspective on how to think about your profession, and bring those people back, because in this second episode, Will's going to talk about the shared learnings that came about that actually propelled him to create a very disrupted company in the world of sales. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.